Imagine trying to build a machine that will completely outlast human civilization.
Yeah.
What material do you actually use for that? Do you go out and look for the rarest element on Earth, or do you take the, you know, the dirt cheap everyday iron beneath our feet and just fundamentally alter its atomic structure?
Right. It's a fascinating question.
It really is. Today, we have a stack of incredibly dense blueprints and engineering materials sitting right in front of us. We're looking at physical metallurgy data, some really complex phase diagrams, and this highly technical thesis that is specifically focused on the extreme heat treatments of iron.
Yeah, it is a truly formidable stack of research to get through. I mean, we're getting into phase transformations, exact cooling rates, matrix structures, and like highly specific alloying ratios.
Yeah, definitely not light reading.
Not at all. It's the kind of data that usually stays strictly locked inside a university engineering department or, you know, a heavy industrial lab.
But our mission today is actually deeply human. Because, you know, on the surface, this is a deep dive into the microscopic structures of steel and cast iron. But remarkably, one of our sources, the really technical thesis on heat treatments, it actually anchors its absolute mountain of data with a philosophical poem from the 15th century.
Which is so unexpected in a paper like this.
It's completely wild. So our mission today is to extract the secrets of endurance. We want to understand how humanity engineers things to last, whether that is a physical alloy subjected to intense industrial stress or like a cultural legacy trying to survive the passage of time. So, okay, let's unpack this, starting with the metals themselves.
Right. To really understand endurance, we have to look at what we are actually building with at a molecular level. And the materials we're looking at present us with a fascinating contrast right out of the gate. We are looking at a whole spectrum of ferrous metals, meaning metals based on iron, and how different elements interact with that iron base to, well, to completely change its destiny.
Yeah. And I was really struck by how the material describes one specific element in this mix. In a very dry, data-heavy section, it actually uses the word enigma to describe cobalt.
Yes.
What makes cobalt behave so differently from everything else?
Well, it earns that title because it completely breaks the fundamental rules of how transition metals normally behave inside iron. Let's look at the crystal structure of steel for a second.
Okay.
When you heat steel up, its internal atomic lattice actually rearranges into a structure called austenite. It kind of opens up, making room for other elements to slip in.
Makes sense.
And then when it cools down, it tightens back up into a phase called ferrite. Now, most elements you mix in strongly prefer to exist in just one of those phases.
Or they force a change.
Or they react with the carbon in the steel to form these hard separate compounds called carbides.
Okay, so normally an added element forces the steel to make a choice, right, or it comes together with the carbon. But cobalt does something else entirely.
It's even stranger than that, actually. Cobalt is the only transition metal that dissolves extensively and seamlessly into both austenite and ferrite.
Both of them.
Both of them. It's completely miscible. It doesn't force a phase change at all. Furthermore, it completely refuses to form intermetallic compounds, and it has almost zero tendency to form carbides.
Wow. It just quietly slips into the background lattice no matter what temperature the iron is at.
Yes, exactly. And by just quietly dissolving into the background like that, it miraculously induces incredible high temperature strength in the steel.
So it's stabilizing it from the inside.
Precisely. Because it sits so comfortably in the lattice, it facilitates what we call aging treatments. Basically, it allows the steel to maintain its mechanical properties under extreme blistering heat.
I mean, it sounds like a super material. You just slip it in, it doesn't cause any structural drama, and the metal becomes incredibly strong under fire.
It is a super material in a way.
But looking at the industrial applications in the text, it seems its main uses are restricted almost entirely to highly specialized tool steels. Why not use it for everything?
Well, the limiting factor there isn't physics. It's pure economics. Cobalt is extraordinarily expensive.
Right, of course.
It gives us incredible endurance, but humanity just can't build a massive, sprawling society out of a luxury metal.
Yeah.
We needed to find endurance in something cheap and abundant.
Which naturally brings us to cast iron. Because if cobalt is the rare, expensive luxury additive, cast iron is, well, it's the cheap, everyday workhorse.
Absolutely.
The data literally calls it the cheapest of all commercial alloys.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at the phase diagrams here, there is a very strict, almost mathematical line that dictates what is steel and what is cast iron. It all comes down to a 2% threshold.
It's a highly critical dividing line. It's all about the percentage of carbon mixed into the base iron. Theoretically, if an iron-carbon alloy has anything up to 2% carbon, it is defined as a steel. The moment you cross that 2% threshold, and, you know, most commercial cast irons sit between 2.5% and 3.75% carbon, it ceases to be steel and becomes cast iron.
I keep picturing this like baking, you know, specifically when you're making caramel.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
Right, because you are boiling sugar and water, and everything is liquid and totally manageable. But there is an exact temperature tipping point where suddenly the sugar just seizes up, the physical state changes entirely, and if you let it cool, it becomes a hard, brittle candy.
Right, right.
There's a tiny fraction of a change in heat or ingredients, and the entire physical reality of the material transforms.
That's actually a highly accurate way to visualize the structural shift, because that 2% carbon threshold completely dictates the physical workability of the metal.
How so?
Well, under 2%, as steel, the metal retains plasticity. It is what we call hot workable. You can heat it up and forge it, hit it with a heavy hammer, roll it into new shapes.
Like a blacksmith making a sword.
Exactly. But the moment you cross that 2% carbon line, it completely loses that plasticity. The carbon essentially locks the structure up. You can no longer forge it. You can basically only manufacture components by melting it all the way down to a liquid and casting it into a mold.
Okay, so if I'm looking at this critically, the text notes that along with that high carbon content, cast iron is also full of other elements like silicon, sulfur, and phosphorus.
Yes, lots of impurities.
Right. And it has zero plasticity. You can't hit it with a hammer without breaking it. So why on earth does the tonnage of cast iron exceed all other cast materials in the world? Like, why is heavy engineering relying on a rigid, impure block that you can't even forge?
Because it magically offsets its lack of plasticity with two incredible attributes. First off, that massive dose of carbon drastically lowers its melting temperature.
Oh, so it takes less energy to melt.
Far less energy. Yeah. And it flows beautifully, almost like water, into incredibly complex molds. Second, it has staggering corrosion resistance against many common media, including a wide variety of acids.
So if you are listening to this deep dive in your car right now, the engine block sitting a few feet in front of you is a perfect example of this. You can't forge an engine block with a hammer.
No, it's way too complex.
Right, you need to pour it into a mold. And you need it to withstand corrosive fluids and intense heat for decades.
Exactly. But to truly understand why that engine block behaves the way it does, we have to look much closer. We have to zoom way, way in past the visible surface, right down to the microscopic architecture.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because when you look at the microscopic photographs of normal gray cast iron, which the text says is the most common form, you realize the carbon doesn't just disappear into the iron.
No, it doesn't dissolve.
It actually precipitates out as graphite. And the physical shape of that graphite dictates literally everything. In gray iron, the graphite forms into these jagged flakes.
Yeah, imagine looking at a microscopic landscape of solid iron, but it is deeply scarred by these long, sharp ravines of soft graphite.
Sounds chaotic.
It is. These flakes have sharp corners that occupy huge areas of the cross-section.
And the data says this makes the iron weak and totally brittle in tension. Like, if you try to pull it or bend it, the metal will just crack right along those sharp ravines.
It will snap right in half.
So again, why build heavy machinery out of a material that is internally pre-cracked with soft flakes?
What's fascinating here is that the structural weakness is actually the trade-off for a mechanical superpower.
A superpower?
Yes, because those flakes are made of soft graphite, gray cast iron is the easiest ferrous metal on Earth to machine. If you are drilling into an engine block to make cylinder holes, your cutting tools are essentially lubricating themselves on the graphite as they cut.
Oh, wow. Built-in lubrication.
Exactly. But more importantly, those sharp flakes give gray iron the highest damping capacity of any common commercial alloy.
Damping capacity, meaning its ability to absorb kinetic energy and vibration.
Yes, precisely. Think about a massive industrial loom or like a factory generator. When a machine like that runs, it vibrates violently. If the metal frame can't absorb that energy, the machine will literally shake itself into pieces.
That makes sense.
But when sound waves and intense vibrations travel through gray cast iron, they hit those jagged graphite flakes. The flakes disrupt and absorb the kinetic energy. It deadens the vibration almost perfectly.
So you trade ductility.
Yeah.
You know, the ability to bend for the ability to absorb massive vibration.
That's the trade-off.
But what if a situation demands both? What if you need the cheap, easy casting of iron, but you also need it to survive massive impact and bend without shattering?
That is the ultimate engineering puzzle.
Right. And there is a visual in the data that honestly threw me for a loop. It's a photograph of a solid bar of cast iron that has been twisted up like a piece of licorice and cold bent into an S shape.
Ah, yes, the SG iron.
I just assume they must have melted it down and used some intense forging process to force it into that shape.
You'd think so, but forging would crack it immediately. That photograph actually illustrates a massive leap in metallurgical engineering known as SG iron, which stands for spheroidal graphite iron.
Spheroidal graphite.
Yes. The secret isn't forging at all, it's chemical inoculation.
So they add something to the liquid metal right before they pour it.
Precisely. Engineers discovered that by tossing tiny, highly specific amounts of magnesium or cerium into the molten iron right before casting, they could fundamentally alter how the carbon behaves as the metal cools.
Just a tiny pinch changes it.
Yep. Instead of growing into those large, embrittling flakes with sharp corners, the magnesium actually forces the carbon to grow into tiny, perfect spheres or nodules.
It's like changing the internal structure of the metal from a stack of broken glass to a pile of microscopic ball bearings.
And that completely changes the physical destiny of the metal. Because spheres don't have sharp corners, they don't act as stress concentrators.
So the cracks can't form.
Exactly. The iron matrix is no longer violently interrupted. Suddenly, you have a cast iron that retains all the benefits of easy casting and cheap production, but now it has incredible toughness, impact resistance, and ductility. You can twist it, and it bends instead of shattering.
Just by sprinkling a tiny bit of magnesium into the melt, we turn brittle flakes into ductile spheres. We completely rewrite its endurance.
It's incredible.
But the engineering doesn't stop with just physical shapes. Because to push this material to the absolute limits of survival, we have to move into chemical alchemy and extreme thermal treatments.
Right. This is where alloying elements come back into the picture. It's an incredibly delicate balancing act. If we want to fortify the base iron, we can add elements like chromium.
Yeah, the data notes that chromium acts as a carbide former, meaning if you add it, it forces the carbon to form hard iron carbides instead of soft graphite, right?
Correct.
And this creates white iron, which is incredibly hard, around 1500 VPN hardness.
Yeah.
But it becomes so brittle you can't even machine it with standard tools. You can only shape it by grinding it.
Right. Chromium increases what metallurgists call the chill. It tightly locks the carbon into a rigid grid. It's amazing for wear resistance, but terrible if you actually need to drill a hole or cut the part.
It's too stubborn.
Exactly. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, you have nickel. Nickel acts as a graphitizer. It actually reduces the chill effect, pushing the carbon to stay loose as graphite, which maintains that easy machinability.
Okay, so chromium locks it up, and nickel loosens it up. And this leads to a brilliantly clever trick outlined in the research.
It's a great piece of engineering.
If you combine them in an exact 3.1 ratio, 3 parts nickel to 1 part chromium, they mutually neutralize each other's effects on the carbon.
Let's look at the atomic mechanism there. The locking force of 1 part chromium is exactly counteracted by the loosening force of 3 parts nickel. The opposing forces on the carbon precipitation just perfectly cancel each other out.
It immediately makes me think of noise-canceling headphones.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
You know, you have the ambient noise coming in, and the headphones produce an exact opposite sound wave. They collide, neutralize each other, and leave you with this perfectly ideal, quiet environment.
Exactly. 3 parts nickel perfectly cancels the chill of 1 part chromium. You keep the excellent machinability of the base iron, but the overall surrounding matrix is vastly strengthened by the alloy itself.
It's a perfect equilibrium.
It is. And once we have that chemically balanced spheroidal graphite iron, we can push it through the ultimate trial by fire. This is the primary focus of the thesis in our source stack, creating austempered ductile iron, or ADI.
The thesis goes incredibly deep into this ADI process. Basically, we take that SG iron with the carbon spheres and we heat it up to between 850 and 950 degrees Celsius.
So it's glowing hot.
Growing hot.
Yeah.
The internal crystal structure has opened up into that austenite phase we talked about earlier. Now, I'm picturing them just dunking this glowing hot metal into a huge vat of cold water to freeze it in place, right?
You would naturally assume that, but quenching it in water would actually destroy it.
Really?
If you cool iron too fast by plunging it into cold water, the atoms essentially freeze in a state of sheer panic. They don't have time to arrange themselves properly, creating a highly stressed, incredibly brittle structure called martensite. It's super hard, but it will shatter under impact.
Okay, so what if you just let it cool slowly in the air?
Then the atoms have too much time to relax. They settle into a soft, layered structure called perlite, which is like a microscopic layer cake. It's tough, but it's not incredibly strong.
So water's too fast, air is too slow.
Exactly. To get austempered ductile iron, you have to arrest the cooling process right in the middle, in the Goldilocks zone. They don't use water, they use a bath of molten salt.
A bath of liquid salt? I mean, that sounds like medieval alchemy. Why use salt?
Because molten salt transfers heat uniformly and rapidly without boiling away like water does, and it can be held at a very, very precise temperature.
Okay.
The glowing iron is plunged into the liquid salt bath, which is strictly maintained between 250 and 450 degrees Celsius. And the iron is just held in that bath for anywhere from 30 minutes to 4 hours.
So it cools down really quickly from 900 degrees, but then it hits a wall at 350 degrees, and the salt just holds it there.
Exactly. It catches the atomic structure mid-transformation. By holding it at that exact intermediate temperature, the austenite slowly transforms into a completely unique matrix called osphorite.
Osphorite.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this osphorite is an intricate, tightly woven atomic structure that provides ultimate structural strength, immense impact resistance, and an incredible fatigue life.
So we're balancing elements at a 3.1 ratio to manipulate carbon, altering the microscopic shape of that carbon with tiny pinches of magnesium, and then bathing the glowing metal in molten salt to freeze its atomic structure in a state of suspended animation.
It's a lot of steps.
It is a staggering amount of human effort to engineer a material to be indestructible, which actually brings us to the core motivation behind all of this. Because right in the middle of this dense, data-heavy thesis on isothermal transformations and osphorite matrices, there is a poem.
Yeah, it is easily the most jarring part of the source material. Nestled right there between charts on cooling rates and complex phase diagrams, the author randomly included a poem by the 15th century Nahuatl poet Nezahualcoyotl.
So what does this all mean? Why drop 15th century Aztec philosophy into a highly technical metallurgy thesis? Let me read the lines from the source. What am I to take with me? Will I leave no legacy on this earth? Let us at least leave flowers. Let us at least leave songs. I leave a memory.
This raises an important question about the intersection of science and humanity. The author of the thesis is clearly drawing a parallel between the poet and the engineer.
Mm-hmm.
On a literal level, the thesis is about engineering materials to survive fatigue and industrial wear. But on a philosophical level, the endless pursuit of the perfect iron matrix is basically the engineer's version of leaving a legacy.
Wow. We are desperately trying to make something that lasts.
Exactly.
We temper our metals to survive the brutal physical forces of the world, the friction of an engine, the violent vibration of a factory, the blistering heat of an industrial furnace, just as we create art and write songs to survive the silent passage of time.
Right. The poet wanted to leave flowers and songs so he wouldn't be forgotten. The engineer is leaving behind an austempered ductile iron matrix.
Both are a defiance against impermanence. The thesis author recognizes that the deep, highly technical work of physical metallurgy is ultimately driven by the exact same human desire as poetry, to build something enduring, to ensure that our efforts on this earth actually survive us.
It completely highlights that metallurgy isn't just about utility. It's about taking the raw, chaotic elements of the earth and applying human intellect to force them into a state of perfection that nature never intended.
It fundamentally reframes the entire stack of sources. I mean, what started as a dry look at carbon percentages suddenly feels intensely personal.
It really does.
We've traced the journey from that strict 2% carbon line that dictates if a metal can be forged or cast, to the microscopic pinch of magnesium that turns sharp, brittle carbon flakes into resilient, ductile spheres.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really did. We explored the invisible atomic push and pull of a 3.1 nickel to chromium ratio and the extreme thermal alchemy of plunging glowing iron into liquid salt baths to forge an osphorite matrix. And finally, we arrived at a 15th century poet asking what we leave behind when we are gone.
It's a beautiful parallel to draw.
Which leaves me with one final thought for you to ponder long after we finish today. You know, we live in an era where we create more information than ever before, our modern songs and flowers. But we store them on hard drives, cloud servers, and flash drives that chemically degrade in a matter of decades.
They're incredibly fragile.
Our digital legacy is so fragile. Yet we are simultaneously engineering these austempered ductile irons to be physically indestructible. So thousands of years in the distant future, when some future civilization digs up the ruins of our society, our digital data will likely be entirely gone.
Completely wiped.
Could it be that our most advanced technology vanishes? And these incredibly tough, perfectly engineered microscopic structures of carbon spheres and osphorite matrices become our true legacy? Will a piece of cast iron be the only song that survives to tell them we were here? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you, and we'll see you next time.